Believe it or not, Cliff, it's time for another episode of Yearview Mirror. This god-awful song, Believe It or Not by Joey Scarberry, came out in 1981, the year we're covering in this episode. It was used as the theme song for the TV series The Greatest American Hero, which premiered that year and was a pretty big hit at the time. The damn song reached number 2 on the Billboard charts. It's hard to believe.
I can believe it, Ken, because I was a big fan of the song and the television series.
That's another hard thing for me to believe.
Well, I was also 7.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, that's a 7-year-old song. But just to remind you that 1981 wasn't this god-awful, this song also became big that year.
Oh, my God. Now, this is a song and a band I absolutely detest. Only Steely Dan beats out Rush on my top 10 worst bands ever list.
Sometimes your taste in music confounds me. I would have thought that you would have been a Rush fan. No.
You're my greatest American hero, Ken.
Hey everyone, it's another episode of Yearview Mirror with Ken and Cliff. I'm Ken. We're a couple of high school history teachers who discuss, debate, and deprecate each other's thoughts and ideas about U.S. history and pop culture.
And I'm Cliff. In each episode, we aim to create a big picture snapshot of one year in post-World War II America by using significant historical events to contextualize a handful of films, television shows, and songs. In this episode, we focus on the year 1981, the beginning of the Reagan era. Ken and I will be discussing the films Raiders of the Lost Ark and The Road Warrior. For television, we'll be featuring the debut of Hill Street Blues and the launch of MTV. And for music, we'll be hearing songs from Kim Carnes, Queen and David Bowie, Olivia Newton-John, and Journey.
All right, Cliff, let's remind everyone about the most important events from 1981. As you just mentioned, Ronald Reagan was inaugurated as the 40th U.S. president at the start of the year, and he would have a hell of a first year. Before becoming the oldest president ever elected, Reagan was best remembered as a B actor in Hollywood and a 2-term governor of California. On the same day of Reagan's inauguration, and with no direct involvement by him or his incoming administration, 63 American citizens were finally released after 444 days of being held in Iran by the new government back in 1979.
Just 2 months after his inauguration, Ronald Reagan took a bullet in the belly when John Hinckley tried to assassinate him in Washington, D.C. Remarkably, he survived, but 3 others were seriously injured. In the summer of 1981, Reagan nominated the very first woman to the Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor, who was later confirmed by the Senate. And a couple of months after that, the nation's air traffic controllers went on strike, and Reagan subsequently fired all of them, over 11,000.
That's remarkable. How do you train 11,000 air traffic? That's not a job that's like, you know, flipping burgers. NASA launched the very first space shuttle mission in 1981. Spaceship Columbia would become the first shuttle to reach outer space. And over the next 2 decades, a series of space shuttles would carry dozens of astronauts into space, reaching several scientific milestones.
In June of 1981, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention published the first report of what will later be identified as the AIDS virus. The report detailed that 5 homosexual men in Los Angeles contracted a rare form of pneumonia seen only in patients with weakened immune systems. By the end of 1981, 141 people died of the AIDS virus. According to the World Health Organization, more than 36 million people have died of HIV since the start of the HIV/AIDS pandemic in 1981. We also need to connect Reagan back to this story because history has clearly proven that Reagan and his administration not only acted very slowly on the crisis, it dramatically cut the budgets of an assortment of federal health agencies who were positioned to battle the epidemic.
All right, we're discussing 2 films released in 1981. The first one is The Road Warrior, a sequel that generated 2 more sequels, and the other, Raiders of the Lost Ark, was an original film that generated 3 sequels. The sequelization trend in Hollywood really took off in the 70s with films like Planet of the Apes, Jaws, Rocky, Star Wars, and there was no turning back when Hollywood executives saw the profits franchise films were pumping out. Let's start with The Road Warrior, which was released outside the United States as Mad Max 2. So again, in the United States, this film is released as The Road Warrior, but in fact, it is a sequel based on the very first Mad Max movie, which had only been released a couple years before.
Would we in America had seen the first Mad Max?
From my research, it was very limited release and more sort of those small independent theaters. And it was a big budget movie. The first one was very, very low budget, and it definitely comes off so on the big screen. It's a post-apocalyptic action story directed by George Miller. It was the second installment in the Mad Max franchise, with Mel Gibson reprising his role as Mad Max Rockatansky. The film had an archetypical Western frontier movie plot, which told the tale of a community of settlers who defend themselves against a roving band of marauders. Max rediscovers his humanity when he decides to help the settlers. Let's listen to a clip from the film's official trailer.
In the future, cities will become deserts. Roads will become battlefields. And the hope of mankind will appear as a stranger. He works alone against all odds. He may be the best chance we've got. The Road Warrior. Pray that he's out there. Somewhere.
I distinctly remember seeing this in the theater as a 21-year-old and absolutely loving it. Not only was it a great action flick, it depicted a not-too-distant future that looked unbelievably grim, unlike anything I had ever seen before. Cliff, after seeing this movie recently, what did you see and hear in this movie that reflected maybe a bigger picture of the world at that time?
Well, I think one of the reasons why this film worked so well and why it became such a global hit was based on the historical context of the 1970s. The Cold War had, for decades, as we've talked about before, instilled a very real fear of a thermonuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union, which, by 1981, had set a widely held presumption that a post-apocalyptic world would look nothing like the world everyone knew. And only a couple years before the film's release, the U.S. and the world experienced an oil shortage, which resulted in high gas prices and long lines at the pump. And then along comes this movie that not only depicted a brutal landscape of nothingness, clearly the result of a nuclear war, but marauding tribal gangs who were battling it out for every last drop of gasoline to fuel their very survival. Let's listen to the scene in the movie when the settlers of the community are debating their fate when Max decides to help them survive.
You can't expect to compete with that. Every day we get weaker while they get stronger. It's finished. I'm sorry.
Two days ago, I saw a vehicle that had hauled that tanker. You want to get out of here?
Clearly, the story needed a hero to save the day and planet, and a young, buff Mel Gibson proved to be the perfect protagonist.
Would you say he was the greatest American hero?
Oh, nice, bringing that early part of the show reference back up again.
Or is he the greatest Australian?
Oh, he's the greatest Australian hero.
Yeah.
As an ex-police officer, he was resourceful, driven, and he had a compassionate heart for those who were being oppressed by lawless thugs.
Ken, this was the first time I saw this film, I think, in its entirety.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a few things.
Okay.
That people might want to take some notes and keep this in mind for the future. I learned that when the apocalypse does eventually come, we'll apparently all be punks when it's over. Or at least we'll all dress like we're Sid Vicious.
Yeah, there was definitely a punk attire theme.
Right, the costumes and the hairdos of the cast were like they were copied straight from the crowd at some punk show at CBGB's in the late 1970s.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
I also learned that apparently, once the apocalypse comes, we all become MacGyvers or members of the A-Team and instinctively know how to repurpose everyday junk into working vehicles, weapons, and other technologies. That's great, because right now I can't do any of that.
Can you change a light bulb?
Yeah.
All right, well, then you're a little bit more MacGyver than you give yourself credit for.
One thing, though, I seemed a little unclear about was the fact that all of these punk dudes, right?
Yeah.
In the film, they're desperate for oil. But it's not clear to me why they need it so bad in the world they're now living in, as they got nothing that requires oil but their cars and motorcycles, and they wouldn't even need the gas so bad for those things if they just stopped driving around in circles all the time, threatening the community that had figured out how to drill for oil and then refine it.
Yeah, I mean, it is an interesting premise that, you know, here they are desperate to get oil and gas, but to what end?
No, there was no end.
Yeah.
After the apocalypse, one of the first things that goes is sense.
The other thing I want to talk about is the film's violence. Back in 1981, the Motion Picture Association forced the filmmakers to edit the film to minimize on-screen violence, a level of violence that we would most likely deem very mild in the 21st century. Cliff, let's talk about on-screen violence for a bit. By 1981, Hollywood and the TV industry were still pretty conservative about the depiction of on-screen sex and violence. But standards were clearly evolving, and it was films like The Road Warrior that were pushing the envelope, and some would say lowering the bar for acceptable standards. You're from a generation that was weaned on more graphic depictions of violence. To what degree should society hold media institutions accountable for the desensitizing of violence? And here's the other part of the question. Has our society declined because of lowered standards of on-screen violence?
As of September of this year, Ken, 2022, there have been over 500 mass shootings in the United States.
In just this year alone?
Just this year alone. Just up till September of 2022. Yeah. So I hesitate to come out on the wrong side of what seems painfully obvious here, namely that we are one violent nation. But have we become so violent because we've become desensitized to it due to our movies and our video games and our television shows? The answer to that question is yes, in part, we have, but only in part. You can't put all the blame on our popular culture, as our popular culture is a production of our overall culture.
That's a good point.
When one of the most important issues of one of our two major political parties is limitless access to guns of all kinds, you can't put the blame solely at the feet of the entertainment industry.
No.
And I dare anyone to try. Let's look at our history. You want to tell me that anything we're putting on the television screen is worse than the Holocaust? It happened.
Yeah.
Right? These people lived it.
Yeah.
Right? Lived the violence. Saw the violence every day. Not depicted.
Yeah.
Real. Actual violence going down. Did this turn that generation of people into monsters?
Yeah.
No. The number one movie of 1981, Raiders of the Lost Ark, remains to this day one of the most revered and successful films of all time. I can tell you that so far in our show's run, there's only been two movies we've discussed that I haven't gone back and watched.
Oh,
I've already saw them before.
Yeah.
And one of them was Star Wars.
Yeah.
And the other one was Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
It's all burned into my brain.
Yeah.
There's no point in going back.
Yeah.
Raiders of the Lost Ark was an action-adventure film that raised the bar for all action-adventure films afterwards. It was directed by Steven Spielberg and starred Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones, a globe-trotting archaeologist up against a bunch of Nazis trying to recover the long-lost Ark of the Covenant, a relic said to make an army invincible. Teaming up with his tough former lover, Marion, played by Karen Allen, Jones races to stop a rival archaeologist from guiding the Nazis to the Ark and its power. Let's jump right to the film's official trailer to set the stage.
For nearly 3,000 years, man has searched for the lost Ark of the Covenant.
The Bible speaks of the Ark leveling mountains and laying waste to entire regions.
Not something to be taken lightly. No one knows its secrets.
Jones, do you realize what the Ark is? It's a radio for speaking to God.
An army which carries the Ark before it is invincible.
The Ark.
It is protected by forces beyond imagination.
The film was originally conceived by George Lucas of Star Wars fame. He wanted to create a modern version of the serial films that were popular in the first half of the 20th century, films that involved a single set of characters, a single storyline, which were then edited into chapters and distributed to theaters on a weekly basis. Lucas was friends with Spielberg back in the 70s, and he convinced his pal to direct the movie. Raiders of the Lost Ark was the first of three additional films, Temple of Doom, Last Crusade, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, and a fifth film is expected to be released in 2023.
But of course, the thing that drew people into the theaters back in 1981 was a compelling, fantastical story and action scenes that redefined what action movies could and should be. Let's face it, who doesn't love films about killing Nazis?
Oh, you gotta love a good movie about killing Nazis.
And also, I will have to say this, as part of the charm of this series of films is part of the charm of the first three Star Wars films. Yeah. It's Harrison Ford.
Yeah. He is the greatest American film hero.
He could be. He really is. But let's address the historical context of Raiders relative to 1981. Once again, and we've addressed this countlessly on this podcast, actually I just brought it up a little earlier, Cold War tensions hung in the air across the planet throughout the post-World War II era. Detente had shrunk those tensions somewhat in the 70s, but when Reagan took office in 1981, tensions ratcheted back up when he repeatedly referred to the Soviet Union as the evil empire. Once again, national security was at high risk, and it reignited the fears of many American citizens. But then comes a macho male action hero against a fascist totalitarian regime who, against all odds, inevitably one-ups the evil villains and secures victory for democracy and the American way. So in some ways, Raiders can be seen as a kind of conservative serial fantasy film.
I think there's validity to that argument. We also can't ignore the fact that Indiana Jones and the Nazis represent Caucasian males who invade foreign lands belonging to people of color in order to steal a local treasure for their own personal benefit. This is something that throughout the course of imperialism of the 1700s and 1800s was done by many of the European and American powers.
Really? I must have missed that portion of...
You know what I'm talking about. So in this way, Raiders is a reflection of Western imperialistic tendencies. And here's another idea that I came to appreciate after rewatching this movie for probably the 10th time. Marion's character, Indiana Jones' love interest in the film, is a feisty, independent, hard-drinking woman who becomes Jones' partner on his adventure. There are a couple of times when Marion is the damsel in distress in need of saving, but for the most part, she plays a vital role in Jones' victory, even saving his life on more than one occasion. Let's listen to a brief clip when Indiana Jones and Marion reunite after many years.
Always knew someday you'd come walking back through my door. I never doubted that. Something made it inevitable. So what are you doing here in Nepal?
I need one of the pieces your father collected.
I learned to hate you in the last 10 years.
I never meant to hurt you.
I was a child. I was in love.
Marion represents a new generation of women who are unafraid and express a desire to share in the fruits of a partnership's labor. So in this way, Raiders can be seen as somewhat as a feminist film. But the one aspect of the film that marked a turning point for Hollywood, and to some degree, George Lucas needs to be held accountable to this based on his hit Star Wars, which was released several years before Raiders, is the notion that the roller coaster ride of the film's action scenes become more enthralling than the story itself. Now, I would argue that Raiders has an enthralling story, but it was really the action sequences that enraptured audiences in such a way that it set a bar for all other action-adventure movies that followed.
There's very few moments in this movie where Indiana Jones isn't fighting for his life, which, of course, is how real archaeologists live their lives.
I don't think so.
Which I wonder how many kids saw this film, then went on to college and majored in archaeology, only to discover that they would be spending most of their work days doing nothing more than using a toothbrush to meticulously sift through some dirt in hopes of finding a piece of a pot some human used 10,000 years ago, and not fighting Nazis and swinging on bullwhips and what have you.
Let's move over to television in 1981. There were two landmark television debuts that year. One was a cop show, Hill Street Blues, and one was the launch of a television network, MTV. Let's first discuss Hill Street Blues. The series ran for 7 seasons. It chronicled the lives of the staff of a single police station located on Hill Street in an unnamed city. Each episode featured intertwined storylines, some of which were resolved within the episode, with others developing throughout the season. The conflict between the work lives and the private lives of the characters were also significant. Let's listen to a short promotional clip from the first season.
The men and women of Hill Street put their lives on the line every day.
Nobody's gonna hurt you, you hear me?
In every possible way.
It's Hill and Ranko. They're both in intensive care.
Doesn't look good.
It's the greatest cop show of them all. Hill Street Blues.
Gotta be honest here, Cliff. I was not a frequent viewer of the show, but after seeing a couple episodes of Hill Street Blues to prepare for this show, it was obvious that a lot of TV cop shows were influenced by Hill Street Blues.
I never watched Hill Street Blues when it was on television because I was too young. I mean, 81, I was 7.
Yeah.
Before Miami Vice aired in 1984, the only cop show I had ever watched was Barney Miller.
Yeah, and that's not a cop show. Let's just be honest. Barney Miller was a great sitcom.
But I did check out a few episodes in preparation for the show, and what I saw was pretty compelling.
Mm-hmm.
I think cop shows are so popular because cops are fascinating characters in our society. Besides firefighters and soldiers, who the hell signs up for a job where you might be killed doing that job?
No, it's an extreme job.
Right? I mean, you think being a teacher is stressful?
I do.
I mean, it is. But imagine having to go into a home and stop a husband from beating on his wife, and then, the very same day, chasing an armed bank robber through some busy street while they're shooting back at you and you're trying to not kill innocent civilians. I mean, the cops, they get a bad rap, and at times they deserve it, particularly during the last few decades in America, but they are essential parts of our communities and our system of law and order.
Numerous TV critics and historians have claimed that without Hill Street Blues, there would have never been shows like The Sopranos, NYPD Blue, The Shield, and even shows like St. Elsewhere and Breaking Bad. Here's a list of the things Hill Street Blues did, which few shows before it did. It had a unique visual style for weeknight television productions, such as filming close in with action cuts rapidly between stories. Handheld cameras were used to enhance the style rather than floor cameras. This technique became almost standard for many shows afterwards.
The show included black folks in the core ensemble cast and featured several interracial and interethnic cop partnerships.
It contained overlapping plots and moral conundrums such as police corruption, racism, alcoholism, and both interpersonal and institutional forgiveness.
The series reflected the rapidly changing world of women's roles in the workplace and at home. It changed the perception of the police force being an all-male operation, including women of varying strengths and weaknesses working alongside men.
But maybe the most important influence was Hill Street Blues' high-quality character writing and non-formula plotting that would inevitably lead to the golden age of TV that we're experiencing now in the 21st century. Some of the distinguished writers for the show included David Milch. He was the creator of the series Deadwood. Dick Wolf, the creator of the Law & Order series. Anthony Yerkovich, the creator of Miami Vice. Mark Frost, the co-creator of Twin Peaks, and playwright David Mamet, most known for Glengarry Glen Ross. All of those guys wrote for Hill Street Blues. That's an impressive roster.
I didn't know that about Mamet.
Yeah. The other major television story of 1981 still lives on today, and the ripple effect of it is still felt across pop culture and entertainment media worldwide. On August 1st, 1981, MTV was launched with these words.
Ladies and gentlemen, rock and roll.
Trivia question for you, Cliff. What was the first music video featured on MTV?
Do you take me for some kind of uncultured fuck, Ken?
Sometimes.
I'll know this when I'm dead.
Oh, okay.
You can kick my corpse
well,
and ask
who
me
is
this.
It, then?
It's Video Killed the Radio Star by The Bungles.
Buggles.
The Buggles?
Yeah, the Buggles.
I heard you on the wireless back in 52.
Damn, Cliff. You were just a tyke in 1981. But MTV for me and my generation was the 1980s.
It was for my generation as well.
When it originally aired, there were an assortment of VJs, video jockeys, who served as hosts for a relentless barrage of music videos from artists like Men at Work, Pat Benatar, The Human League, and Phil Collins. Phil Collins always seemed to be on MTV. Music videos had been around, of course, for decades previous to MTV. The Beatles, in the mid-1960s, were the first big act to release music videos and even feature films to promote their records. There were numerous acts who did the same over the next couple of decades, but it was the launch of MTV which really consolidated these videos onto a central network and elevated the music video to not just a marketing ploy, but an art form unto itself. It would take a couple of years, but by 1984, record companies saw the writing on the wall and started churning out increasingly big-budget music videos to promote record sales and market music personalities.
But as MTV grew in popularity and influence, so did the controversy that surrounded it, especially as it related to racial and ethnic diversity. In the early days of MTV, it was pretty obvious the majority of videos were from predominantly white artists. MTV executives denied racism and argued they were just following the rules of the rock business, which was pretty much dominated by white artists. In 1983, David Bowie called out MTV in a live interview with VJ Mark Goodman.
It's evident in the fact that the only few black artists that one does see are on about 2:30 in the morning or to around 6. Very few are featured predominantly during the day. I'll say that over the last couple of weeks, these things have been changing, but it's a slow process.
Also in 1983, CBS Records threatened to remove all CBS artists from MTV if the network didn't play Michael Jackson's video for Billie Jean. Can you imagine not playing Michael Jackson's video for Billie Jean?
It seems incredulous today that Michael Jackson would be scorned or ignored on MTV, but he becomes one of the first black artists to really become highly marketed on MTV.
Oh yeah, he was, as far as I know, he was like not only the king of pop, he like the Thriller album not only made him the king of pop,
yeah,
but he also had a video for so many of the songs. The Thriller,
big budget,
the
videos.
Thriller video.
Yeah.
I mean, he became the king of video,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah. What's ironic is that by the late 1980s, MTV fully embraced black culture with the release of one of its most successful shows, Yo MTV Raps, which featured a variety of rapper hosts like Fresh Prince, Dr. Dre, and hip-hop legend Fab Five Freddy. Some have claimed, and rightly so, that without MTV, rap and hip-hop would not have crossed over to the white youth market as quickly and successfully as it did in the 1990s. The Christian right also stirred up controversy when they publicly accused MTV of promoting a, quote, pro-sex, anti-family, pro-choice drug culture, unquote. In addition, the Parents Television Council released a study titled MTV Smut Peddlers, which sought to expose offensive content on the channel. But in the end, that only increased viewership and MTV's popularity. It should be noted that MTV censored numerous videos over the years that contained references to drugs, sex, violence, weapons, racism, homophobia, and overt advertising promotion.
During the 90s, MTV made a clear break from the music video format and introduced original content like the reality shows The Real World and Real Rules, and the animated show Beavis and Butthead. From 1995 to 2000, MTV played 36.5% fewer music videos. MTV president at the time, Van Toffler, stated, "Clearly, the novelty of just showing music videos has worn off. It's required us to reinvent ourselves to a contemporary audience." And reinvent themselves they did, as you could watch MTV for days during the 21st century and not see one single music video played.
And it's not like music videos disappeared. I can go on to YouTube right now and pull up virtually band is going to have a music video for a song, but the clout that MTV once carried in terms of promoting an artist via their video, that's over. Cliff, it's time to talk about the music of 1981, and more specifically, time to ponder the question how this piece of crap became the number one song for the entire year of 1981.
She's got Betty Davis eyes, she'll turn her music on you.
Betty Davis Eyes by Kim Carnes was, in fact, the longest standing number one song at 5 consecutive weeks in the summer of 81. Cliff, what's your theory on why this song was so popular?
First of all, I'm a little surprised that you feel this strongly against it.
It is so profoundly disposable pop that has nothing really catchy about it for me. Is that not the case with you?
I've never minded the song.
Oh, okay.
Here's a couple reasons why it might have been so popular. It's profoundly simple,
with that
classic 80s synthesized sound and a clap track that you can tap your foot to. It's got a mysterious voice. I mean, is it Rod Stewart?
And it has a Rod Stewart sound.
He was really big at the time. Or some chick who just woke up from a night of too much partying. I thought she sounded like a little bit like Stevie Nicks.
And I don't like Stevie Nicks.
And I do.
Yeah.
And most likely because there was a ton of blow being done around that time, and there's no accounting for taste when you're coked out of your mind for 5 consecutive weeks.
We should probably provide some context as to who the hell Betty Davis was. Davis was a well-known actress from the 30s through the 1960s, appearing most notably in films like All About Eve and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. She often played characters who were unsympathetic or had a hard-edged morality, so Betty Davis' eyes could signal someone who is not to be trusted. However, she also had this cool, seductive quality to her that gave off an arousing and boner-rising appeal, I might add. So Betty Davis could either be a compliment or an insult. Either way you look at it, Cliff, I think this song blows, and you are less of a human for liking it. Time to inject some quality music into the conversation and convince our audience that not all 1981 music sucked.
Sorry, Ken, but I don't think this next song would be what you would call quality music. Released in 1981, Olivia Newton-John's mega hit, Physical, spent 10 weeks at number one on the Billboard 100, making it the biggest hit of 1982 and of John's entire music career.
Holy crap! The only thing I remember about this song, Cliff, was the music video, which not only was, dare I say, risque, but was on MTV, it seemed, all the frickin' time.
Yeah, the song's success is clearly evidence of MTV's growing influence in the early 80s, as you recalled, and it's an image that is indelibly imprinted in the deviant minds of most males who saw it. The video featured Olivia Newton-John in a tight-fitting workout outfit, at first working out with a bunch of overweight schlubs, but then replaced by a bunch of super buff dudes who were clearly gay because they seemed totally disinterested in John. The song was censored and even banned by some radio stations as a result of its sexually suggestive content, like the line, "There's nothing left to talk about unless it's horizontally."
Wow. Oh, Olivia, whatever happened to the sweet, innocent Sandy Olsen from Grease?
I'll tell you what happened to Sandy, Ken. She got greased up 3 years later in this video and was slipping and sliding all over a bunch of barely dressed dudes. That's what happened to her. In a survey taken by Billboard magazine, Physical was named the number one sexiest song of all time.
Are you kidding me?
I wonder what year this was that this survey was taken.
I don't know.
The runner-up was Rod Stewart's Tonight's the Night.
We have yet to cover a Rod Stewart song. We're going to have to fit Rod in somewhere.
Not to mention... That's what she said. I used to sing a parody of this song every morning to my first period students.
Oh, I love those stories when you serenade your students, right. Cliff.
Ken and I teach at a school with a dress code where students can't wear hoodies but must wear collared shirts, and believe it or not, since it's a STEM school, they gotta wear a lab coat.
Oh, that's so nerdy.
So I would stand in front of the room and dance and sing, "Let's get uniformed, uniformed, I wanna get uniformed." I think they hated my singing even more than they hated the uniforms themselves.
All right, enough of this. Let's please talk about some quality tunes from 1981. Oh, yeah. Now we're talking Vanilla Ice, baby.
No, Ken, we're not covering 1990. But Vanilla Ice did try to steal this song for his own fame and fortune. I think they call that sampling, not stealing.
Well, I think in this case, when the judge put the gavel down on me, I think he lost.
Yeah, this song is Under Pressure by Queen and David Bowie. Without a doubt, one of rock music's greatest collaborations. The story goes that Bowie was so dissatisfied with the proposed final arrangement of the song, he threatened to prevent its release. However, after some compromise, the song was finally released, and it went to number one in the UK and peaked at number 29 on the US Billboard charts.
I'm not a mega Bowie fan, but one of the things I noticed about this song was how it carried over into Bowie's most commercially successful record released just 2 years after this song. That record, Let's Dance, was Bowie's biggest success, and you definitely hear elements of Under Pressure throughout that album.
As noted earlier, American white boy wannabe rapper Vanilla Ice sampled the song's bass line for his 1990 hit Ice Ice Baby, without crediting Bowie or Queen, resulting in a lawsuit costing Vanilla Ice some pretty substantial bucks.
I think it was significant.
And a lot of artistic credibility. I love this.
I love this song.
I think this is what Queen's finest hour.
Yeah. I've never been a big Queen fan, but this is a song that I will always turn up the volume to anytime I hear it. I also think that the song's lyrics had a lot to do with its success and acceptance. All of us have experienced some degree of pressure in our lives, but the one constant that gets us through the hard times, through the insanity of reality, is simply love. And the closing words of the song summarize that point so well. All right, we have one last song from 1981 to talk about, and even playing the first couple of seconds will trigger a rush of memories from anyone that's ever heard it before.
Don't Stop Believin' by Journey, one of rock's greatest anthems, has experienced even greater success in the decades after its release than it did as the lead single to Journey's seventh album, Escape. That's incredible that Journey had that many albums by 81.
Yeah, no, they were not hugely successful in the 70s during that sort of Loverboy, REO Speedwagon era, but they were around.
The song is credited to the entire band, but the song's title stemmed from a phone call between keyboardist Jonathan Cain and his father. Cain was brand new to the band in 81, but just years before, he'd expressed his doubts of making it in the LA music biz to his father in a late-night call. His dad's words of "Don't Stop Believing" stuck in his head enough to stick it out and parlay a spot in the band and help create one of rock's enduring classics.
I love that father-son story.
This song is unusual in that its chorus hook doesn't arrive until the song is nearly finished. Jonathan Cain also credits Bruce Springsteen for the song's creation. He said, quote, "What I wanted to do was get a little Springsteen going on. Bruce was a master of that, bringing his audience into his songs," end quote.
But it was the use of the song in many TV shows and films that have kept this rock classic alive and kicking even to this day. It was first used in the 2003 film Monster, starring Charlize Theron. And then the floodgates opened, and it was used in such films and TV shows as Scrubs, South Park, Wedding Singer, King of the Hill, Cold Case, My Name is Earl, Just Shoot Me, Rock of Ages, Glee, and of course, most famously, in the concluding scene of The Sopranos' last episode in 2007. Question for you, Cliff. Do you consider it a sellout when musicians let film and TV repurpose their songs for reasons not at all connected to the song's original intended purpose?
If the song is used artfully in a film or television show, absolutely not.
Okay.
But when it's used just to sell salad dressing or bed sheets,
yeah,
most certainly so. And you need to not advance to go.
Yeah.
What the fuck? I don't care.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Do what you want with your music. It's your music.
Don't stop.
Hey, it's time once again for our personal favorite media release for 1981. I'll go first. Oh yeah, baby. Listen to that funky groove. That twinkly keyboard rainfall. That slinky, sexy bass line. It's one of my favorite songs of all time, Cliff. It's I Can't Go For That, No Can Do from Daryl Hall and John Oates. The duo blended pop and soul so perfectly. They were obviously heavily influenced by the Philadelphia soul sound of Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff and groups like the Spinners, the OJs, and Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. But in 1981, they released this song, which was from their 10th album, Private Eyes. I mean, seriously, Cliff, this song is so freaking smooth.
I would argue that this song needs no introduction, as it's one of the most instantly recognized songs ever produced by a human being. In the Air Tonight reached number 2 on the UK singles chart. It reached number 1 in Austria, Germany, Switzerland, and Sweden, but peaked at only number 19 on the Billboard Hot 100 in the United States. What's so great about In the Air Tonight is that the music perfectly matches the lyrics. In the chorus, he tells us over and over again that he can feel it coming in the air tonight. And we, the listeners, know exactly how he feels because the stark, menacing, highly digitized music makes us feel it too. Then the almost deafening rumble of thunder pounds into our ears and we know the storm has finally come. An awesome song with an awesome drum break by a not so awesome artist.
I'm so glad that you're able to sort of recognize that Phil Collins clearly had talent, but he sometimes wrapped it around, you know, very maudlin, insipid songs that didn't really have substance. This song had substance.
There is no other song like this.
Yeah.
This is just, it's a one of a kind.
Yeah.
Please share Yearview Mirror with Ken and Cliff, with your friends and family, Indiana Jones, Mad Max, The Buggles. You can always find us on kenandcliff.com and drop us a message about what you like and don't like.
Make sure to listen to next week's episode as we profile the year 2005, the year of an infamous hurricane, the films Brokeback Mountain and V for Vendetta, the TV debuts How I Met Your Mother, and one of my favorite TV shows of all time, The Office. We'll also hear the music of Kanye West, Mariah Carey, Shinedown, and Gorillaz, a band of cartoon characters.
Please share Yearview Mirror with Ken and Cliff with your friends and family. You can always find us on kenandcliff.com and drop us a message about what you like, what you don't like. Join us next time on Yearview Mirror with Ken and Cliff.